This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
What do you do?
I am a writer, a doctor, a nuclear physicist, a theoretical philosopher. But above all, I am a man. Hopelessly inquisitive man, just like you.
That's Philip Seymour Hoffman and Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master, one of the fall's most highly anticipated releases. This week's Film Spotting Top 5, the fall movies on our must-see list.
Plus, David Cronenberg's Cosmopolis, starring vampire-turned-thespian Robert Pattinson, and interviews with stand-up-turned-filmmaker Mike Birbiglia and director Craig Zobel.
All that and more ahead on Film Spotting.
Film Spotting is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals.
For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting.
Hey, Film Spotting listeners. Do you remember waiting in line in the rain for concert tickets? Have you ever made your own top five list? Have you come to blows with a friend over the Beatles versus the Stones debate? Then you, my friend, are not just a cinephile. You are a true music fan. But don't fear. There's a home for you every week. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. We're the hosts of Sound Opinions, and every week we bring you what you need to know in the world of rock and roll. From interviews with people like Brian Eno and Bootsy Collins to performances by Wild Flag and Arcade Fire. Plus, the week's music news and album reviews. So whether you're the first to tweet news of the latest Panda Bear release, or you haven't bought a new record since Frampton Comes Alive, we've got a place in the conversation for you. Because we're music critics, but like you, we're also fans. And admitting it is the first step.
Subscribe to Sound Opinions for free on iTunes or at soundopinions.org.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam Kempinar. I'm Josh Larson. We'll discuss David Cronenberg's new film, Cosmopolis, and preview the fall movie slate later in the show. But we begin with the new comedy, Sleepwalk With Me, and co-director, co-writer, and star, Mike Birbiglia.
Mike is probably pretty well known to many of our listeners from his multiple appearances on This American Life. Host Ira Glass appears briefly and is a producer of the film, which opens in select cities this weekend and dramatizes Birbiglia's real-life rise in the world of stand-up comedy while struggling with relationship issues and a nasty sleepwalking habit. I caught up with Birbiglia when he was in town for Chicago's Just for Laughs Comedy Festival in July. Here's our conversation.
So here's what happened. My girlfriend Abby and I moved in together. She's great. And my sister Janet got engaged.
You're next.
Coming your way, baby. Better up.
And everyone started talking about marriage.
How long have you and Abby been together?
8 years.
I don't remember being so long. That's ridiculous.
And that night,
Abby!
I started walking in my sleep.
There's a jackal in the room.
Come back to bed.
How long has this sleepwalking been going on?
I don't think it's that serious.
As things with my girlfriend got more tense, my sleepwalking got more dangerous.
You did it, Matt, in the first place.
Thank you!
This is the first time I remember thinking maybe I should see a doctor. And then I thought, maybe I'll eat dinner. I went with dinner.
You know, Mike, even though I'm on public radio, I am shamefully not up to speed with what's going on with public radio.
Oh, yeah.
So a lot of people know you from This American Life,
sure,
and
yeah.
The Moth. And the first time I actually became aware of you, the first time I heard you was on Mark Maron's podcast on the 200th episode of WTF.
Or when I interviewed him.
Exactly. And so that was a lot of fun. And then the first time I saw you was just a couple of months ago here this summer on Lena Dunham's Girls on HBO.
Girls, yeah.
I think it was the third episode, and you're in a scene. It's just one scene, very memorable scene. That not only was my favorite scene of that episode, and maybe the whole season, but one of the funniest things I've seen all year in anything. Frankly, it was just hilarious, where basically the setup is she's desperate for a job. She's interviewing with you. It's going really well.
Yeah.
It couldn't be going better. You guys are just really connecting and finishing each other's sentences, and it's really funny. And then she just takes it a step too far.
Yeah.
And I just have to ask you about it because I love that scene so much. I really just want to know how that scene kind of came about, how much of that just happened, how much of it was really written and on the page ahead of time, and how much fun was it to shoot?
It was a really well-written scene. I'm friends with Lena. She was very instrumental in the making of my film. I saw Tiny Furniture and her film, and we became friends, and she read a lot of drafts of Sleepwalk With Me and gave notes on it. And then when she was making her series, she said, we have this part, and it's this funny scene, and here's how it goes. And I did it. And then we ended up improvising quite a bit. And I think a lot of that ended up being in the final product. But as written, it's hilarious, too. I mean, it's just a funny scenario, and she's a brilliant writer and a great director. I mean, the way that she was able to direct me and being in the scene at the same time was a good learning experience for me, because that's what I ended up doing in my film. I'm the star of my film, and then I direct it.
Was there anything in particular that you can share that you really remember taking away from watching her do that helped you on your film?
Just utter calm. Lena is a very self-possessed person, and she just has confidence about what she wants, and she's not afraid to ask for it, and she has real vision.
You showed up again as a scene stealer. This time I recognized you in your sister.
Recently
Lynn Shelton on the show, and Mark Duplass as well. Big fan of that movie and their work. Again, a scene stealer. You're kind of in one scene there at the beginning of the film, but it's really funny where you're giving a eulogy of sorts to someone who's passed away.
I hope that doesn't become my new reputation as
the
scene stealer actor.
We're going to get to your movie, I promise. This is it for other people's work. But just talk about that experience working with them. You actually had an interesting credit, and I didn't write it down, but at the end of the film, they listed you as kind of one of the
creative consultant, I think, is what they did, but which was very generous. I mean, that Lynn was very generous to offer that, certainly I didn't ask for it, but it just because it's an improvised film,
mm-hmm.
and that scene was, it was an eighth of a page on the page, and then we improvised all that stuff, and it was, for me, seeing the film was really shocking because I've improvised since college. I was an improv group. I was cast my freshman year at Georgetown in this group, and we used to make pilgrimages to Chicago. My improv group would make road trips, and we would come and we'd go to Improv Olympic.
Kind of the Mecca.
Second City, right. And Annoyance Theater, and we would see everything. We would just see every show. And as a matter of fact, the first show I ever saw at Second City was called Paradigm Lost, and it had Tina Fey, Rachel Dratch, Scott Adsit, and Kevin Dorff, who are just four of the finest improvisers there are. And anyway, so I've been improvising for a long time, but then I went on to move to New York and have a group at UCB Theater called Little Man. It was myself and Nick Kroll and a bunch of other comedians and actors. But to see it filmed.
Yeah.
To see your improvisation filmed and then that it exists on the big screen for the rest of time, it was actually shocking.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Well, let's get to Sleepwalk With Me, your new film, where you are the writer and the star and the director of this movie, telling a very personal tale. And as I was watching it, I'm a big Woody Allen fan. I couldn't help but think about Annie Hall.
Of course,
where
yeah.
you've got obviously a relationship film, and a film about a relationship in bloom already, but then kind of disintegrating before our eyes a little bit, but also the direct address to the camera.
Mm-hmm.
The scene in the film where the sleep doctor, I'm forgetting his name, shows up.
Dr. Dement, yeah.
Yeah, is talking to you, recalled Marshall McLuhan showing up at the theater.
Oh, yeah, sure.
There a little
yeah.
bit. So was Annie Hall an influence on you?
Oh, yeah. I think it's an influence on all
Everybody.
Things that came after it.
Any romantic comedy.
Yeah. Every book, every movie, every television show. But yeah, for me particularly, like the films that really interest me and are just films that make me feel and laugh. You know, it's a really simple qualification for me for movies and like James Brooks movies I love, you know, Broadcast News in terms of endearment, you know, Annie Hall, Manhattan, that whole – Hannah and Her Sisters, that whole era I just love. You know, recently Sideways and you know the Alexander Payne mm-hmm. films and Lena Dunham's film Tiny Furniture. I mean that's just sort of the goal. But you know, with Annie Hall was definitely a template because it's also a movie about a breakup.
Yeah,
and it was like how can you make a breakup funny, and well, how can you make dangerous kind of death defying levels of sleepwalking funny also.
So Matt, we heard about the Dustbuster Olympics. You know, so Linda, can you get the book in your purse? Could you get the book for me, please? Yeah, I picked this up for you. The Promise of Sleep. Got one for myself as well.
Oh, thanks.
Can I see? It's great, Dr. Pennyman. That's exactly the kind of thing we need.
There's some dangerous situations you can get yourself into. You ought to see a specialist.
It was very minor.
It wasn't minor.
Well, I put in a call to Dr. Latham. He conducts these overnight sleep studies.
I appreciated that, but right now I'm really busy.
With what? Folding napkins into triangles?
This just doesn't seem like a dinner conversation to me.
You know, Matthew, you say you're going to go see the doctor. You don't. You say you want to be a comedian. You're a bartender. I mean, pick a goddamn plan and stick with it.
He's kidding, but he's not as funny as you.
I mentioned Marc Maron earlier, the podcast. He does play a small role in this film, but a
yeah.
pivotal role where you're
he plays Mark Mulhern.
Mark Mulhern. I want to ask you about that in a moment, too. But it's a key role because he plays the veteran comedian, and you're trying to get your feet wet. You're on the road, and you're not doing particularly well. And you say something that's really kind of vulnerable and shows a side of you that's really personal, and he says, why don't you go up on stage and
yeah,
say
why don't
that?
You say that?
And
yeah.
then that's where the film takes off and your career in the film starts to take off because you finally have found your voice. Was there anybody like that for you in real life who gave you that kind of advice or really made you have that epiphany?
Well, Mark Maron, not Mark Mulhern, actually was one of those people, among others. I mean, my first manager was this guy named Lucian Hold, and he was the manager. He was the talent booker for the comic strip on the Upper East Side, which is kind of a legendary club for 30 years, you know. So he booked, he's passed away now, but he had booked, you know, Chris Rock for the first time, Jerry Seinfeld for the first time, Ray Romano. And one of the things he said to me that was really pivotal in my life is he said, you know, if you write about yourself, no one can steal it. And as a comedian, that's a really hard thing. Is there's a lot of joke stealing, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of, you know, there's frustration because we're all kind of swimming in the same pond to some degree, same topics. And if I talk about sleepwalking on stage. I talk about all these things. You know, in my book and on stage, I talk about having a tumor in my bladder when I was 19 and going to the doctor and dealing with that. And I feel like the more specific you get to your own life, the less likely it is that anyone else is going to do something like it.
We're talking with Mike Birbiglia, the writer, director, star of the new movie Sleepwalk with me. And you mentioned Mark Mulhern. You do add this layer of artifice to the film where it's clearly your story in many ways, though I'm sure there's a lot that you add or embellish. But you did decide to alter the names a little bit. Instead of Mike Birbiglia, you're Matt Panamiglia.
Yep, and Matt Panamiglia, yeah, which is, of course, a joke.
And what was the reason, though, behind that?
We kind of – I mean, Ira and I talked that through. And
Ira Glass from This American
Life. Ira Glass, yeah, who's a co-writer, and Seth Barish and Joe Birbiglia, who are co-writers of the screenplay. Mm-hmm. And we talked through, like – you know, there's a lot of autobiographical or semi-autobiographical films historically, and the ones that we wanted to emulate more were more like Annie Hall as opposed to, you know, Private Parts, which is Howard Stern's autobiographical film, which I love actually. I love both of those films. But I felt like with Annie Hall, he was able to have the name Alvy Singer, which is, you know, it's a little bit of a goof on his own name. And then Diane Keaton is Annie. I mean, they call – he calls her Annie in real life and people call her that. And that her Hall was her maiden name.
Right.
Yeah. And so it was a little bit of that. We were like what we feel like we're doing is more in the vein of Annie Hall than Private Parts, even though we like both of those movies.
So you are trying to set a clear signal that – a lot of this is true, but it's not all true, and we are having some fun with it, and there is this layer there.
Yeah, and I always tell people the things – when people ask me what's true, I say the things that you wouldn't expect to be – could be true are true.
Yeah.
And the stuff that is kind of minutia and you wouldn't even think about is probably made up or fudged for timeline or just convenience.
I actually – before this interview, I read what you had to say with the AV Club, though I think it was from 2 or 3 years ago you did an interview there, and you said something really interesting. You said, when I started out, I was like a character of myself. In some ways, it's so shameful when I look back on it. I'm like, why couldn't I just be me? Now I'm so transparent, it's a joke. I don't know where I'm going to go from here. So that was a few years ago.
Why did I say that?
Where have you gone from here? And what are the pitfalls of putting yourself out there so transparently?
It's interesting because it makes it more challenging. The more you put yourself out there, the more you have to say, what's next? What else can I say? What else can I what else can I do? And I think honestly, like, you just have to dig deeper. It's funny, whenever I've worked on stories with Ira Glass for This American Life, we've done about 6 or 7 stories over the years. We did that story about how I got in a car accident. I was hit by a drunk driver and made to pay for the drunk driver's car.
It's
called
Return. Mark Maron, wasn't it?
I told him a little bit of that. Yeah. It was on this episode of This American Life called Return to the Scene of the Crime.
Oh, yeah. I did hear that recently.
Whenever I do stories with Ira, it's really interesting because I'll come to him and I'll say, I have this story. I have this story. I have this story. And then he'll go, it's okay. And then I'll say, well, I did have this thing happen, but I would never say it on stage or publicly. And then I'll say it, and you know, like that story, the car accident story, was like that, and of course, always those are the stories where he says, "Yeah, that's the one we're gonna do," you know, and I'm like, I don't know, I'm gonna have to run this past a bunch of people and my wife and my friend Andy and make sure this is okay.
Come up with some clever names.
Yeah, exactly. But those are the stories that are interesting, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. They've proven to be so far. What then are specifically the challenges for you of taking what you've done on radio and on the stage, off Broadway, and bringing it to a film?
It's, you know, in film, it's just very visual.
Yeah.
And fortunately, we had this tremendous cinematographer named Adam Beckman, who had actually shot the This American Life TV series, who brought a lot of innovative ideas for how to shoot these really elaborate dream sequences on a budget. You know, we shot the film for like less than $1 million.
Wow.
And it was the upside of that is that there weren't a lot of kind of studios and fingers kind of coming in and saying, we want it like this. We want it like this. We want to appeal to this demographic more. You know, it was just us.
Yeah.
It was just us kind of making these decisions. And the obstacles were making the film cinematic and making it visual, and that's the thing that I feel like I'm most proud of, is that it captures something visual, which is, you know, dreams, which we've all seen in films before, of course, but sleepwalking, which I don't feel like I've seen. I mean, I feel like there's the kind of the honeymooners cliche of the guy with the arms in front of his body as he's walking and like a zombie.
Right.
Like the zombie walk thing.
Yeah.
And then you've got like olive oil in the Popeye cartoons in the construction site.
There's nothing particularly menacing about it or
no,
dangerous.
And so we tried to capture what it actually is like to sleepwalk. And
it's interesting because watching it, I was thinking about some moments from my own life. I'm on here on Film Spotting, I'm on my third co-host. And when the other two hosts left, they were 4 years apart. And in both cases, amicable splits. But it was such a change in my life that mm-hmm. I actually went through a phase of about 2 weeks where I would wake up in the middle of the night and I thought I was dying. I was choking. I was actually gasping for air. I thought something was in my throat, and I would get up and I would kind of run down the hall as if I was trying to get this out of my throat to breathe. And my wife was freaking out, like, what is wrong with you? You know, I mean, it's amazing how those things from your life can subconsciously start to creep in and affect you when you sleep. And so what we see in the film is you dealing with it, or not so much dealing with how that's happening. You're kind of in denial about it.
Mm-hmm.
Why were you so much in denial about it versus accepting that you had to look into this a little bit and examine it?
I say in the film, I say, you know, at this point in the film, I just fallen off. I'd sleepwalked up onto a cupboard in my living room, and then I'd fallen off it and landed on the floor, and I was bleeding. And I say in the film, you know, at this point I thought maybe I should see a doctor, and then I thought maybe I'll eat dinner, and I went with dinner for years, you know. And in real life, I think that that's pretty similar. It's convenience, and it's also – I feel like the denial of the character has a lot to do with – being a people pleaser. I feel like you don't want to rock the boat.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to make trouble. You know, it's like, and that's the same thing in his relationship. He knows that he and his girlfriend from his college sweetheart shouldn't be together, but it's just, it opens just a can of worms. And maybe if I just see this through, it'll work itself out. That's the greatest lie that we all tell ourselves all the time. This'll work itself out.
Yeah. And that idea, that notion of just kind of hoping it will work out, and I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, I don't want to spoil anything, it comes back in a major way
in
this film, certainly. But there is a great moment, speaking of visual moments, though it isn't something that certainly involved probably some intricacy with the camera. Lauren Ambrose in the film, great actress, plays your girlfriend in this movie. And there's just the moment where you kind of know, I guess to go back to Annie Hall, it's the moment when they know they've got a dead shark on their hands, right, is when they're at a wedding and taking a family picture, and it comes time to have your girlfriend come into the photo, and you just have that awkward moment where the look on her face and the look on your face says it all.
They ask me, do you want Abby in the photo? And I just pause.
Yeah.
And then my dad says, oh, of course he does. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's...
But how did you sort of massage that beat visually on
camera? That was
very
difficult. It's interesting that you should ask about that. That was a very challenging thing to get on film, because that was based on a real life incident, and it was in the one man show.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very delicate, and it was a feat of cinematography on the part of Adam, and then a feat of editing from our editor Jeffrey Richmond, who edited The Cove and Sicko. He brought a lot of innovative ideas to the film that really make it what it is. But yeah, that was a hard thing to get across, because very subtle. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of kind of tight shots but also you have to go wide because you need to understand the spatial relationship.
Sure. And you can't over communicate how dramatic it is. You do have to be subtle with it.
Yeah, and I think actually what sells it particularly is the scene right after it, where they're driving home in the car, mm-hmm. and they're just not talking. And that was just like, I mean, we were just driving around in Brooklyn, no one else in the car, just me and Lauren, and Adam Beckman, our cinematographer, riding with the camera rigged on the car,
uh-huh.
and then he was just riding focus with the monitor himself, with no assistant in the car. I mean, it's the three of us, and we, you know, made that whole scene. And
that's amazing.
It was absurd, because that's actually one of my favorite shots in the whole movie.
Yeah.
And he actually pulls focus manually on between me and Lauren,
uh-huh.
as we're driving.
Wow.
And it was just one of those. We shot for about 10 minutes and captured a bunch of stuff and then went with that.
You talked about improvising, even though the scene was really well written with Lena Dunham in that episode from Girls. How much goofing around, how much going with what was on the page and then improvising did you do with this film?
Well, it was very targeted improvisation. So in other words, there are certain scenes that have to be a certain way for the construction of the narrative to work. But then the scene with the comedians hanging out, that's pretty much all improvised. It's me and Wyatt Cenac, Henry Phillips, Jesse Klein, who are all comedian friends of mine. And what I really wanted from that was I just wanted to feel like a bunch of friends hanging out. and because we wanted to see the character Matt Pendimiglio to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted everybody to know in the audience, like, this is where he should be. You know, I literally wrote in the script, if we ever release the script, you'll see that, you know, the comedians are hanging out. Matt knows, and I wrote in caps, all caps, these are his people.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's all I wanted.
I actually had a crazy gig once where these two Orthodox Jews had asked me if I would perform at, like, their art gallery.
Yeah.
They told me there were going to be hundreds of people there. And then I go, and it's
okay.
Just...
Yeah, go for it.
It's just their apartment, and
yeah.
It's just them.
So it wasn't like a show.
No.
It was like a conversation.
It was more like a quiet conversation.
I did this one show. It was in the parking lot of a Home Depot. The only people we're performing for are, like, the migrant workers who are just hanging out there. I'm going up last, and I'm watching every other comic just eat it, just tank. But I'm thinking, like, I want to get some response from these people. Like, I should close strong. What Spanish do I know? And I'm like, I know, I'll say long live the immigrant. And I'm like, all right, everybody, this has been fun. Viva la migra, which is long live the immigration police.
For me, like, that's what improvisation does to films, is when you have something that you can't quite express with dialogue. You want a magic. You want something that is so real it's you can taste it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's – I think that that's what it does. And
yeah.
Why it's an act improvises that whole story about Home Depot. Performing in the parking
really
lot
funny.
Of a Home Depot.
Yeah, and Lynn Shelton's really good at this too, obviously.
She's
making
brilliant.
That
yeah.
feel so real. At the same time, it doesn't feel at all like someone's just searching for something to say interesting on the spot. There's something that really comes naturally and honestly out of that. That has to be – a very big moment for anybody, I assume, as a stand-up comedian too, but we all have certain circles we run in, and to some extent you're always trying to be accepted. Do you remember that moment for you as a comic when you had that moment where you're like, hey, these are my people. I actually belong here. They're not kicking me out of here.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, yeah, there's a few comedians, you know, Henry Phillips is one of them, and my friend Greg Warren and Augie Smith and I feel like there's a bunch – I don't know if it's a single moment, but there's a certain club that I feel like comedians are a part of that has no rules or organization or union.
Uh-huh.
I mean, talk about a group of people who can't organize. Comedians are definitely that because they can't agree about anything and everyone's always making jokes and, you know, it just always falls apart. But I feel like whenever I run into comedians, whether we're at a hotel or in a hotel lobby or a comedy condo like it is in that scene or at a bar, it's like comedians have an instant place to pick up the conversation where you feel like you've known these people for
mm-hmm.
years because you have this common experience of we've stayed in the worst hotels in America. We've performed in the shadiest bars
right.
in front of strangers who hate us. And there's very few people who share that.
Yeah. But there is a great moment in the film where that first night when you're on the road, you're staying at a crappy hotel, you still act like a kid and get up on the bed and jump yeah. up and down and have a good time, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just thrilled. The Backstreet Boys, I wanted that. That way
perfect
playing.
Use. Yeah. Probably spent most of the film's budget on getting
yeah,
the rights
90%
to that.
Of the budget is the Backstreet Boys rights.
I figured. I want to close by asking you about one of the visual flourishes in the film. You did bring up trying to tell this story with a camera, obviously on screen. And there is one intricate kind of bravura camera moment where I think it's when you're checking into the hotel and we get that long, pretty elaborate tracking shot. I almost felt like it was the anti-Goodfellas, you know, where instead of going into the Copa and it's all regal and
sure.
look at the VIP treatment, this
yeah.
is the life of the stand-up comedian on the road checking into La Quinta Inn. So what was your approach to that scene and how complicated it was to pull off that long shot?
Well, we were always looking for myself and my co-director Seth Barish and Adam Beckman, our cinematographer, we're always looking for opportunities to have shots like that
mm-hmm.
where it was a long take. And long takes are hard, and especially on a small budget, because you're to light an area like that is hard.
Mm-hmm.
And so it, when we were scouting that location, which was at a La Quinta Inn, actually, which is where it takes place in the film, you know, I think Adam was pointing out that, like, you know, there's natural light coming in from here. We could light this here. There's a lot of places to hide light. There's a lot of places to – a lot of ways in which we can hide the camera because
mm-hmm.
there happened to be a wheelchair accessible ramp that goes up next
to the
stairs.
Yeah.
And so it's almost as though we pulled off this wild studio shot in a location that is real and feels real. And as we were scouting it, it became clear, oh, this is particularly good for the story because we need to know that the character is walking to the second floor.
Yep.
And so when something happens, I won't spoil it, but that's important to know that he's on the second floor. We already know it because it's in the long take.
And
so we were lucky to pull that off. But even on the day of shooting that, we were like, can we even pull this off?
Sure.
We weren't sure.
How many times did you have to do it?
Did about 6 times.
Did you?
Yeah.
Well, not only does it serve the story in that way, but that real-time sense of urgency just adds to your kind of – your in some ways at a low moment. I mean, or you're extremely stressed out at that point and you're on the phone and you're it just adds to that sense of how distracted you are and how many things are going on in your life. I think it really adds to that.
And Andrew Hollander's score does a lot to heighten that sense of stress as well.
Mm. The film is Sleepwalk With Me. Mike Brugge. I knew I'd screwed up.
No, I like that you did. I like – keep it in, please. Please.
I probably will. The film
Sound it out.
Sleepwalk With Me, Mike Birbiglia.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your time. Best of luck with the film.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
My parents have been together 40 years, which is, but it's too long. If you're ever in a relationship that's moving toward marriage and you're not ready, don't go to my sister Janet's wedding.
My thanks again to Mike Birbiglia. Sleepwalk With Me opened in New York last weekend and expands to the top 20 markets, including Chicago, this weekend. You can learn more about the movie and where it's playing at sleepwalkmovie.com. To hear our complete conversation, visit filmspotting.net or look for it in iTunes. The interview will be available as a separate download. And for whatever it's worth, the movie has been a success so far. It broke the house record at the IFC Film Center last weekend in New York and also scored the highest per-screen debut for an American non-animated film from a first-time filmmaker. So congratulations to Mike Birbiglia.
I do have to see it. I think it's going to hit a sweet spot for me probably. I'm just in awe of stand-up comics.
Yeah.
All stand-up comics, but maybe particularly those who are really struggling and have to go through that experience. It was interesting what he said about being more personal, and that's kind of where he got to the good material, to the gold stuff. That really makes a lot of sense from the stand-up comedians who I've seen on stage.
Yeah, that's where things really start to click in the film. It's fun to watch him as a comedian really discover his voice.
Hey, I'm also glad to hear that the night terrors stopped that you had in between co-hosts that you talked to Mike Birbiglia about.
Exactly.
I didn't realize that you were going through such trauma, and it's nice to hear you're through that.
You know, change can be very, very dramatic and traumatic. I made it through somehow, and so far you haven't caused any further night terror.
That's
so
a relief.
Thank you for that, Josh.
You got it. All right, keep that interview in mind when we perform Massacre Theater next. It's just a little hint for you there. Plus, we're also going to take a spin in Robert Pattinson's limo for our review of Cosmopolis. Adam, if you haven't had your annual physical yet, don't worry, there will be a doctor on board. Stay with us.
Every time I leave, every time I leave, I miss you. More and more each time, more and more in a blink, I've missed you. Every time I see, every time I see, I wanna thank you. More and more each time, more and more with interest I appreciate. There's something I could say that might make it go away, but each time I try,
Film Spotting is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment, providing digital versions of tens of thousands of audiobooks for download to your computer, iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, and iPod. Listen whenever and wherever you want, just like the podcast you are listening to right now. Audible has more than 100,000 titles to choose from. Every genre, Audible has it covered.
A few recommendations we have for you this week. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the 50th anniversary edition, unabridged by Ken Kesey, narrated by John C. Reilly. How about that?
Huh.
So as if it wasn't one worth checking out already because it's a famous book and a great film, it's also narrated by one of our best screen actors, John C. Reilly. And I flagged that one too, Josh, because that's a movie that's in the Film Spotting pantheon. Mm-hmm. It's a movie I adore, and yet really didn't factor into my top 20 greatest films ever
conversation
at all.
Yeah.
So I wanted to give it a little bit of love here in this segment. My next recommendation is a book I haven't read. I'm guessing somehow, though, Josh, you have. You're more learned than I am. You seem to be up on these things. And unlike me, you actually love your children and read books to them. So maybe you've come across Bridge to Terabithia by Katherine Patterson. That's out in an unabridged version. And the reason I highlighted it was it's narrated by Robert Sean Leonard.
That's an interesting choice as a narrator. I can see that working. I haven't read this one.
No.
Myself or to my kids. Sorry to disappoint you.
Yeah, you really do disappoint me, Josh. How dare you? But Robert Sean Leonard was in my mind when we did our contest last week on the show to name your favorite movie that takes place in a school. Dead Poets Society came up a lot in our listener emails. And of course, he's the tragic hero of that film. And finally, Winter Journal by Paul Auster, one of my all-time favorite writers. The book is described this way, a highly personal meditation on the body, time, and memory by one of our most intellectually elegant writers. I certainly agree with that assessment, and that meditation sounds like one I'd like to dive into. Cinema fans may know Paul Auster from the movies Smoke and Blue in the Face. He wrote Smoke. He directed and wrote Blue in the Face, though a lot of it was improvised, but just a great author. And those are my three recommendations this week. If you've got an audiobook you love, want to share it with our listeners, email us feedback@filmspotting.net. We might feature it on an upcoming show.
For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting. That's audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting.
You're the end of the old and the beginning of living even. And I'm a human being who's been meaning to tell you something.
Okay, so what else? What else do I need to know? Put away some money so you can die someplace warm. Don't ever touch it. Not for anyone, ever.
Okay. Is that it?
Don't ever risk your life or your career for an asset. It comes down to you or them, send flowers.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. That's Robert Redford and Brad Pitt in the movie Spy Game, I believe a 2001 film directed by Tony Scott, who tragically took his own life on August 19th. And we recently got this note, Josh, from longtime listener Alex Renaravello. I hope I'm saying that right, Alex. Adam, I just want to say thank you for mentioning Spy Game in your top five cinema spies. Spy Game was an honorable mention of mine. It's not only my favorite Tony Scott movie, Alex writes, but also one of my favorite movies, period. I think it's a unique story and all about characters, not explosions, highly underrated. I'd actually completely forgotten, Josh, that I'd included Spy Game in that top five cinema spies list from a few weeks ago, but that is definitely a movie I appreciate.
Yeah, you do see that coming up in the list of his best films, actually. It's one of his I do like. I'll say that, and maybe we'll get into more in bonus content.
We definitely will in our bonus content this week, which you can get if you have the Film Spotting app. You can get that via iTunes or from Amazon's App World if you're an Android user. You can get all the information you need at filmspotting.net and click on apps. We are going to talk about Tony Scott in a little bit more detail, go through his filmography and touch on some of the films that stand out for us. We'll also share a few of your emails and a voicemail responding to our top five cinema spies. That's all in bonus content right now. It's time for Massacre Theater, where we perform a scene from a screenplay badly, and you get a chance at winning a prize. Last week on the show, Josh and our guest Michael Phillips massacred this scene.
Look, Dave, I can't put my finger on it, but I sense something strange about him.
Still, I can't think of a good reason not to put back the number one unit and carry on with a failure mode analysis.
No, I agree about that.
Well, let's get on with it.
Okay. But look, Dave, let's say we put the unit back and it doesn't fail, huh? That would pretty well wrap it up as far as Hal was concerned, wouldn't it?
Well, we'd be in very serious trouble.
We would, wouldn't we?
Mm-hmm.
What the hell can we do?
Well, we wouldn't have too many alternatives.
I don't think we'd have any alternatives.
That's Cara DeLay as Dr. Dave Bowman and Gary Lockwood as Dr. Frank Poole in 1968's 2001 A Space Odyssey, directed by who else? Stanley Kubrick, written by Kubrick along with Arthur C. Clarke.
We chose this because it was something of an omission on our list. We came up with our own top 10 films of all time list because of the Sight and Sound list that recently came out. Michael Phillips didn't have it. You didn't have it. I didn't have 2001. We're probably going to hear a lot about that because it was number two on the director's list and number 6 on the critic's list, but nowhere to be found on our show.
Yeah, it had to be part of Massacre Theater because I felt like 2001 had to be included somehow in that epic two-part Sight and Sound show. It was an oversight, though it wasn't one that we overlooked unintentionally.
No, I mean,
we
thought
all
about
three
it, yeah.
really appreciate it and certainly considered it, but didn't make our top 10. In fact, didn't even make our top 20 for any of us.
Yeah,
yeah,
you're probably
so
right.
Well, we're apologizing for that right now. Obviously, a landmark film, one of those movies I'm in awe of and respect maybe more than I love. But of course, I have only seen it once, and I've never seen it projected. So it's something that really warrants a little bit more consideration than I've given it.
Do you think offhand it would have been your Kubrick film if you had to put one on there?
It's so hard because actually last night as I was preparing for this show, Full Metal Jacket was on TV and I got sucked right back into it. Man, that's a good film. And of course, The Shining has come up a million times on this show.
Yep.
Paths of Glory, The Killing. There are so many great Stanley Kubrick movies. I don't know if I'd put 2001 even as the number one. I'd probably put Strangelove there, actually.
Would you?
Yeah.
I'd put it ahead of Strangelove. I know that. And it probably would end up being my number one.
Well, last week, you and Michael did a great job massacring that scene. It was a two-part scene. I had to just sit there and play the role of Stanley Kubrick. Very intimidating. And you guys did a wonderful job. But all listeners here, they hear the finished product. They hear how great you are delivering those lines. What they didn't hear off air was how many takes I put you through to get there.
Yes.
137.
It was.
It took 137 takes, but you finally got it.
To be completely honest, I think we had the magic about 96. I didn't quite feel like we needed to keep going.
You don't have my ear. Why don't you reach into that brimming film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner?
The winner would be Dan Muse from New York City.
Congratulations, Dan. Email feedback@filmspotting.net and we'll set you up with your prize.
That was the greatest acting I have ever seen.
I just don't know how you do it, Gary. How do you make yourself so somber and emotional to make everybody cry like that?
It's not that hard, really. I just think about the saddest moment in my life.
It's time now for this week's edition of Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com, the premier location to discover, explore, and share great independent foreign and classic cinema. Film Spotting listeners receive the first 30 days free.
Support Film Spotting and sign up now at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Fandor, essential films instantly.
You already gave a little bit of a hint to our listeners if they were paying attention.
More.
Don't think we need to say anything else, Josh. You have the harder part here, the more lines anyway.
Yes.
Are you ready?
I need a deep breath, but okay, let's go.
And action.
At least once in his life, every man is a genius. And I'll tell you something, it's going to be more than once in your life for you. It's going to be a number of times because you've got it. From what I've heard here, yeah, you've got it. And you're stuck with it. And I don't care if you wanted to get rid of it, you couldn't. It's always going to be there. Now, I know there's no formula for it. I just don't know how you do it. And I'm not curious, mind you, because I want to use the material. I want you to understand that. I'm just curious because I don't know how you do it. I really have to ask you that. How do you do it?
I think it's that I look at my whole life and I see the awful, terrible things in my life and I turn it into something funny. It just happens.
And scene.
If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Tuesday, September 4th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
That's also the location where you can participate in our weekly Film Spotting poll question. Anticipating our discussion of Cosmopolis this week, we were curious how great you think David Cronenberg is. Where do you rate David Cronenberg as a filmmaker? Here are your options. Every film was brilliant. He's one of the best. Some films are brilliant. He's as good as his material. He's creepy, violent, and weird, and Canadian. I'm not a fan. Or I think I watched Goldblum turn into a bug once. Basically, I have no opinion on David Cronenberg. Josh, how did it come out?
Not many people wanted to offend Canadians, as we apparently did with our poll, because the last place option with only 6% was creepy, violent, weird, and Canadian. Then came, I think I watched Goldblum turn into a bug once. That received 11%. He's one of the best. Only 13% of listeners voted for Cronenberg as one of the best. That middle ground won out, 70% with some films are brilliant. He's as good as his material.
Well, we'll get to this week's poll question a bit later in the show. Right now, let's decide whether Cosmopolis is creepy, violent, weird, brilliant, or all of the above.
Where is your office? What do you do exactly? You know things. I think this is what you do. I think you acquire information and turn it into something awful.
What does it mean to spend money? A dollar?
million.
Don't trust standard models. Think outside the limits.
You need to be inflamed, don't you? This is your element.
This is a protest against the future. They want to hold off the future.
That's a scandal, man.
Dying's a scandal, but we all do it.
He's out there, and he's armed.
Makes me feel free in a way I've never known.
Free to do what?
I don't think we've gotten a really good cinematic take on the 2008 financial crash and its aftermath yet. I know you, Adam, were high on Margin Call, but I found it, frankly, to be a bore. Wall Street Money Never Sleeps was worse, vapid, mostly uninterested in the economics that should have been driving its story. I think Cosmopolis, directed by David Cronenberg and based on a Don DeLillo novel, gets us closer. Oddly formal, taking place mostly in the backseat of a limo, the movie stars Robert Pattinson of Twilight fame as a 28-year-old investment titan named Eric Packer. He travels across New York City taking various meetings with advisors, and he also has a particularly unpleasant one with his doctor.
It doesn't seem to be too unpleasant for him.
Well, it was unpleasant to watch. Can we say that?
Yeah, we can say that.
Now, by no means does Cosmopolis offer any explanations or answers in regards to the roots of the recession. But in its own surreal way, it seems to capture the spiritual angst of that time, an angst we're still living with. Where would you place it, Adam, in the context of the films you've seen about the financial crisis? Did it illuminate recent history for you in any way?
First of all, you've already written about this movie and you've had a week to process it. I've had an hour, so
yeah, you're at a bit of a disadvantage.
I hope you're ready to carry me. You're the limo driver in this scenario. I'm just along for the ride.
That's
on this
about
one.
The only place I'd want to be in that
yes,
limo.
Absolutely.
Actually. Well, in the, maybe not how it
in
turns
the front
out. Now
seat. You're somewhat safe there
yes,
in the front seat
yes.
in Cosmopolis. I'm not sure I can say Cosmopolis illuminated anything concrete for me, mainly because I don't think Cronenberg is interested in illuminating anything concrete whatsoever. This is a very abstract, ethereal film. But what really struck me about it, Josh, is how it seems like it could be so of this time right now with the Occupy Wall Street movement, the anti-capitalist or at least the anti-avarice sentiment that's certainly prevailing right now, and the inequality gap that seems to widen every day. And yet it wasn't surprising at all for me to learn that it's based on a novel by Don DeLillo that came out in 2003 when the dot-com bubble was bursting. So he's transplanted that perfectly here to this time. And I think if there's anything concrete that you can latch onto with this movie is that Cronenberg perhaps is saying that this is nothing new. As one character in the film repeats about halfway through, it's nothing original. It's nothing original. It's a sort of continuum we see at work here. The technology is different. The terminology might be different. The narrative, though, seems to be the same. And I particularly love how time and space break down completely inside that limo. It's like a cocoon that can feel so spacious and sometimes keep the people in it really far apart, or they can be right on top of each other with no air to breathe at all. It really becomes its own sealed universe. And that makes sense because it's not any more real or imaginary than the one outside. And I liked getting lost in that world, as bizarre and at times creepy and disturbing and weird as it was. I enjoyed being lost in that world.
The sound is so crucial to creating
right.
what you're talking about. For a while there, it almost has this muted, you feel like something's off on the soundtrack because it is so hermetic and sealed. And then he opens the door for the first time and just steps out and we get the inrush of the city sounds. I really appreciated that effect. I think maybe you're hitting on why I feel like, okay, this is the financial crisis movie I've been waiting for, is because it isn't so specific.
Exactly.
And maybe those others got bogged down, or at least Margin Call for me did get bogged down in the specifics. And Wall Street was just kind of not even interested at all. So it was going off in its own direction. Here we have something that is timeless in its own eerie way, yet has so many reverberations to the things we are seeing. You mentioned the Occupy Wall Street, and it's like an Occupy movement gone berserk at one point where the limo is attacked. And they come at it with graffiti. And I love how Pattinson's character barely blinks an eye. You know, he doesn't even notice that it's being attacked, really. And just that sort of arrogance. I think the movie does, with the Pattinson character, capture the arrogance and the hubris. But it also captures the common man anguish, especially as the movie proceeds. And it makes room for all of that. It isn't really a good guy, bad guy depiction of these forces. But it makes room for all of them. And we see the characters are almost like symbols. I mean, you really do come to watch them as characters. They're not vapid when I say symbols. I don't think they're vapid, but they do stand in for things. They take on the attributes of things like greed and immorality and hopelessness. All of these things become embodied by the various people who step into this limo.
All these limos.
girls, my God. That you can't tell one from another. We could be kids on prom night. Or some dumb wedding wherever. What's the charm of identical?
That I'm a powerful person who chooses not to demarcate his territory with singular driblets of piss is what? Something I need to apologize for?
I want to go home and tongue kiss my Maxima.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. We're talking about the new David Cronenberg film, Cosmopolis, starring Robert Pattinson. We disagree on margin call. I think there's a lot of good drama there in addition to all the specifics, but they're very, very different films. And I ultimately agree with you with your point about how this movie maybe captures it as well as you can capture something that is so abstract, so complex and esoteric and far-reaching. I don't know that any amount of research and data is going to really help you. An expert could sit here all day long and talk to us about derivatives and try to make us really understand what went wrong with the market to cause that ripple effect that ran through not only our country, but the whole world, how it's affected everybody.
Because it's so absurd.
It wouldn't allow us to really wrap our heads around it because it is so absurd,
as
you know.
And so the movie embraces that absurdity, and I think that's why it works. You know what this actually reminded me of in the way it does that is Richard Kelly's Southland Tales a little bit, in the way it just goes absolutely crazy. But somehow the craziness is an accurate refracting of our real world.
Yeah.
Now, they're very different films. Obviously, there's musical numbers in Southland Tales and so forth. But some sort of aura was similar between the two, I felt.
I can see that connection. But there is that line where a movie goes completely off the rails and I no longer have anything at all to latch onto. Like Southland Tales, this movie didn't do that for me. I think that sometimes to try to get at the core of a crisis like this, not just financial, economic in nature, but existential in nature, is to see it in the face of Robert Pattinson's character, to see it in his behavior, as we do in this film. And I did see a quick interview with David Cronenberg where he was asked about the lack of logic in the narrative, and he said, there's no way anybody can follow some of the things Samantha Morton's character says, for instance. She's actually the character, I believe her title is Chief of Theory.
I love that.
Chief of Theory.
Love to be in a position to hire a Chief of Theory.
Exactly. It's pretty wonderful what her title is, and I think that's a pretty fun scene overall to hear her espouse some of her off-the-wall theory. She's the character who says it's not original, by the way. But Cronenberg goes on to say that I think of it like a sci-fi movie where the intergalactic pilot is explaining the way his spaceship works. You don't need to know what he's talking about. You just need to believe that he knows what he's talking about. And according to Cronenberg, Eric Packer, Robert Pattinson's character, understands when his chief of theory is explaining how the future connects with capitalism. It excites him, and that's all you need to know. I agree. You can tell that it excites him, and I think it is all we really need to know to latch on to this film. You made mention of Richard Kelly in Southland Tales. I was thinking of David Lynch and Mulholland Drive and Blue Velvet and some of his other really successful films, where that lack of logic in the narrative is something that just really isn't necessary when everything else is clicking and all that matters is the way the characters interact with each other. And I think Robert Pattinson's performance is another big reason why this movie works. This is my first exposure to him. I haven't seen any of the vampire movies.
That's right. You
haven't
gotten around to Twilight yet.
That Reese Witherspoon movie. No, so this is new for me other than seeing him on The Daily Show a few weeks ago. And he has to embody a lot of things at once. He has to be brilliant. He has to be completely plugged in and completely unplugged. He has to be disaffected and disillusioned, but at the same time, in control and completely out of control. And as you said, symbolic, but somehow still flesh and blood. Someone who's still thinking, who is still feeling, is still trying to learn and in some ways expand himself. You feel like throughout the film, he just keeps taking on more information and changing as a person, even if he's not changing for the better. He is human, and I think that's a credit largely to his performance.
There's a poem I read in which a rat becomes the unit of currency.
Yes, that would be interesting.
Yeah, that would impact the world economy.
The name alone, better than the dong or the quacha.
The name says everything.
Yes, the rat.
Yes, the rat closed lower today against the euro.
Yes, there is growing concern that the Russian rat will be devalued.
White rats. Think about that.
Yes, pregnant rats.
Major sell-off of pregnant Russian rats.
Britain converts the rat.
Joins trend to universal currency.
Yes, U.S. establishes rat standard.
Yes, every U.S. dollar redeemable for rat.
Dead rats.
Yes, stockpiling of dead rats called global health menace.
I think the performance works in all those ways, and the one that impressed me the most is the way he's able to keep up with all these really thick ideologically dominated dialogue scenes. I mean, these are a lot of pure dialogue scenes.
And it seems like it makes sense to him. It seems like he's processing it perfectly,
and especially
even if we're not.
Right. And with Samantha Morton, I mean, they're really going back with some thick stuff that may or may not mean anything. I think she's the one who says, after she espouses some theory to him, I know nothing of these things. Mm-hmm. Isn't that the phrase she keeps returning to? Which is some sly humor in there, too. But yeah, Pattinson keeps up with each of these actors who come in and is able to match them in terms of verbal wits. The real test comes at the end when Paul Giamatti shows up in this finale. And Giamatti has just an absolutely scenery-chewing performance. I think it still works within the context of the film and is
really
brilliant.
I don't think he's chewing
actually,
scenery at all.
But it's kind of framed that way. He has a grand entrance. Mm-hmm. They save him to the end, and it turns into this one man against the other final 15 minutes. I mean, it's certainly in a bad actor's or a showy actor's hands could be seen as scenery chewing. But
I agree.
It definitely works within the context of the film. But bringing this back to Pattinson's performance, that's the real test when he goes up against Giamatti and is able to match him there too.
That's so funny because I was watching that scene and was taken out of it enough. Maybe you just can't help it if you're in this line of work where you're watching Giamatti sitting across from Robert Pattinson mm-hmm. and thinking about Pacino and De Niro sitting across from each other in Heat and wondering, is Giamatti really believing that this guy's up to this? Are they really on equal footing here? I don't know what Giamatti felt or not, but in the scene, you think they're on equal footing.
Yeah, and
they
that's
absolutely
all that matters.
Both belong in that scene as equal. So I was thinking of that as well. But the fact that he stands up to Giamatti and pulls it off, I think, is something worth noting. And I love what Cronenberg does in those scenes where I wouldn't call the pace of this movie rapid. I wouldn't say there are a lot of cuts, but especially there in those last 15 to 20 minutes, it really slows down. There are a couple really beautiful, still long takes where you just see them having a conversation and the mood, the tension, it becomes combustible where you almost wait for the violence. And this is a key bit of subject matter for Cronenberg. Not only does he deal with it in History of Violence,
sure.
but it comes up repeatedly in this film as well. You're waiting for some bit of violence to shatter that tension. You almost welcome it when it comes, which is an interesting trick I think Cronenberg pulls off. But you really have no idea at all, not only where this film is going to go, but especially in that scene, you have no idea where their conversation is going to go. And Cronenberg takes us along for the ride. I was with him the whole way.
There's some interesting staging going on within the room that final scene takes place in
mm-hmm.
and how they move around it and how the conversation turns. It's a really fantastic finale. So getting back to Cronenberg then, and you touched on his issues with violence and the way he's tackled that in previous films. Did you find this to be a Cronenberg film in a lot of ways? Because one of the things I appreciated about it was that it is a return to form in my mind,
mm-hmm.
whereas A Dangerous Method, I didn't really connect with, partly because it seemed much more Masterpiece Theater-y.
I know, I had the same reaction.
Cronenberg, and I'm not saying that Cronenberg couldn't change. You know, it's kind of one of those tough things where you want a director to grow, yet to completely leave behind the things you've always found really interesting can be a problem. Here, I think even more so than you mentioned History of Violence or even Eastern Promises, this deals with those sort of primal bodily concerns.
Absolutely.
That have always been these icky yet compelling aspects of his career. And
mm-hmm.
case in point is that doctor visit we've referred to a couple times because it's uncomfortable.
Well, speaking of that, I think it would be really interesting to see this movie with different audiences. I just came from a viewing of it where there were maybe only 8 or 9 other people in the crowd. Two of them got up and left about halfway through, which didn't surprise me at all. Maybe it surprised me that more people didn't get up and leave. But if you saw it with the right audience, this movie would be pretty hysterical. This movie would be hilarious, and not in an unintentional way. When you have a character repeating the line, "My prostate is asymmetrical," I don't know that you can argue anything but Cronenberg is going for some laughs there. There is absurdity on a grand level
right.
being portrayed on screen here, and it comes through in some of that dialogue. I think it could be very funny. I agree with everything you said about some of those Cronenbergian concerns that come through here, and I too was struck by how cinematic this film seems. I know there are some critics out there who took issue with guys like us who complained that A Dangerous Method didn't seem cinematic enough. But it wasn't because it was too talky. It's just because there was a certain flatness and a lifelessness to the images
yeah,
that I felt. In this film, it's even more talky than Dangerous Method
is. I was going to say, this is a talkier film,
I think. It's far more talky, and it all is confined in these small spaces, whether it's a limo or a rundown apartment or an office, wherever it might be. It almost always takes place in a confined space. And yet it feels so much more cinematic. The images are really, really striking here. And you compare that to A Dangerous Method, which takes place in these wonderful European locations and somehow feels like it's stifled on a Hollywood studio set somewhere. Here, again, you've got people in a limo for most of the film, and somehow it feels sweeping.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, it's very interesting visually, much more than A Dangerous Method. I think it also, getting back to the body issues, goes in a different direction than some of his previous films, because I've always found those to be reflecting psychological states. That's what he's used, a lot of these weird body things that are going on. And here the invasions reflect also a socioeconomic state because of the subject matter and the other things you see going on outside of the limo. So it's kind of this sense of corporate rot, like societal rot,
yeah,
that he's exploring here. And so, again, that theme he uses, and to have the body be a reflection of that, really functions in an interesting way.
Well, to end on a completely trivial note after that wonderfully profound statement you just made, wasn't in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy the answer to everything, the meaning of life or something, the number 42?
Was it 42?
I think that comes up in that film and that book, of course. In this film, 41. Did you notice 41 comes up multiple times?
Yeah, that's
Paul
right.
Giamatti's character is 41. Juliette Binoche, who has a small role in this film, at one point comments that she's 41. It's a prime number. Something about numbers and the mathematics of it all, which factor into this movie in a major way. I'm convinced that this whole film could be deciphered if you just could understand the number 41.
You think so?
That's the secret to the entire film.
I don't know. This is getting into Lost territory now, and I'm already getting a headache. So,
well, Cosmopolis is out now in limited release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and facebook.com/filmspotting.
So in honor of the upcoming big screen adaptation of Les Mis, Adam, how about we sing our most anticipated fall movies?
We shouldn't punish our listeners that way.
Not going to happen. Well, the Film Spotting Top 5 plus Adam's interview with compliance director Craig Zobel is next. Stay with us.
Now for our Film Spotting thank yous, and after a 2.5 hour show last week and another one that is creeping up there in time, looks like another epic podcast, I want to thank every listener who is somehow still listening to us babble on and on. Josh, this segment is brought to you, as always, by the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith. It's been a very busy summer for Jeff and his podcast. He posted 3 new shows this week. How about this one? It's a Tony Scott tribute double feature where they screened True Romance and Domino and did Q&As with the screenwriters of both of those films, talking about their memories of writing for Tony Scott.
Nice.
So, of course, that's a Q&A with Quentin Tarantino and Richard Kelly.
Uh-huh.
How's that for company? You can hear them on the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith. They also posted an interview with Mike Birbiglia and Ira Glass about Sleepwalk With Me. So Jeff is now trying to one-up me. That's fine. Also posted a show with rock star / screenwriter Nick Cave and director John Hillcoat about their new film, Lawless.
So we do 2 shows in a week, and he's got to show us up by doing 3.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
There's going to be a war, Jeff. There's going to be a war. Also, don't forget to check out Jeff's new iPad magazine, Backstory. More information is available at backstory.net. The music you're hearing this week, our featured artist is a group I had never heard of until we got this email from Chris Gallagher in Tulsa, Oklahoma. They're called Ruben's Accomplice.
I know from time to time you take listener recommendations for music to play on the show, and I have one that I believe is right in your wheelhouse. The band is Ruben's Accomplice from Phoenix, Arizona. I've been listening to these guys for years, and they recently released their third full-length album, Sons of Men. Since getting my hand on it, I have hardly been able to stop listening. It was supposed to be released over 3 years ago, but due to numerous setbacks, it is just now making its way into the world. Even with all that time compounding anticipation, they have managed to surpass my high expectations with masterful songwriting and rich instrumentation.
Well, thanks for the recommendation, Chris. I listened to about 30 seconds of two songs, and that was enough to hook me.
That's all it took, huh?
That's all it took. I knew we were going to feature him this week on the show. I also wanted to get to the results of a recent contest that happened over at our Facebook page. It was the day of our Sight and Sound recording, and I finally had my list all together. I waited to the last minute. So I went to our Facebook page, facebook.com/filmspotting, and I put out the challenge. Whoever can guess the most number of correct entries from my list is going to get a Film Spotting t-shirt. So what are the 10 movies you think I'm going to include? How predictable am I? Got a lot of entries, and I appreciate everyone who took the time to submit your 10 picks, sometimes more than 10 picks. And actually, we ended up with five listeners who correctly guessed five of the 10. They had different arrangements of those five.
Okay.
But David Germer, Mike Esty, Andre Cadu, Philip Schaefer, and Arit Frost all correctly guessed five of my 10 choices. So I had to come up with a tiebreaker. And what I decided was, well, I'll extend it to the top 20. In those 10 picks, how many of my top 20 did they get right? David, Mike, and Andre got 7 of the 20 right. Philip and Arit got 8 of the 20 right. So it's still a tie. And rather than come up with another tiebreaker, I'm just going to give them both t-shirts.
Yeah, I think that's the way to go. But was this really much of a challenge? Because according to that algorithm you put together about all our picks, including Michael Phillips, you had the most conventional
list. No, Michael Phillips did.
He did? Yeah. You were in the middle?
I was in the middle.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, my average score was 73, so watch it or I'll bust out your cholesterol.
All right.
No, on the show.
We don't need to hear that.
No.
Well, then
no,
I guess this was a bit of a contest.
No, if anything, just the fact that these people have been listening to me talk about these films for 7 years and about half of them, 4 or 5 of them, were in the Film Spotting pantheon, probably not hard. But, you know, what was interesting is seeing people make picks like Mulholland Drive over Blue Velvet, and I went Blue Velvet. Or they picked The Apartment as a Wilder movie instead of Double Indemnity. Or they went The Godfather 2 instead of The Godfather. So there were some nice discrepancies that were fun to see in their lists. And congratulations to the five people who tied and ultimately to Philip and Arit, who are going to get those Film Spotting t-shirts. Okay, let's get to our thank yous and donations this week. We have a new $10 a month donor. This is a really nice note, Josh.
Just wanted to write you a quick note to let you know that this $10 a month donation is for my husband, Eric. Often, to my dismay, Film Spotting seems to foster his pretentious movie habit. And by pretentious, I mean anything in black and white, foreign, and or older than 1980. Still, you are both forgiven because there is nothing we enjoy more than spending our quiet Saturday mornings listening to your show together. Of course, occasionally those mornings turn not so quiet when one of your insightful reviews sparks a heated argument between us. As long as we avoid listening to your review of the next Terrence Malick release, our marriage should remain safe. And honey, I'm still right about Malick. With many thanks for your hard work and dedication, Randy and Eric Winter from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Well, it's not completely clear from that message what side Randy comes down on Terrence Malick.
That's what I was wondering.
I'm going to guess Randy's wrong. Based on what I read, I'm going to say that I'm sorry, Randy. Your husband is actually the one who's right about Terrence Malick.
But Randy's the one making the donation, so I think we should say she's right.
Actually, you're right. I take that back. I take back everything I said. Thank you both, Randy and Eric. A new $5 a month donor. This is Kagan in Salt Lake City, Utah.
It's a privilege to be able to donate and keep Film Spotting on the air. I also wanted to throw out that because of Film Spotting, I have become an Audible subscriber and I have a Squarespace website.
That's great, Kagan, but where's your Film Spotting t-shirt?
I'm a beginning.
You know, we got merch to buy.
I mean, come on.
That's not enough.
A little commitment here. I'm a beginning film and video game composer, and it's the perfect place for me to build a sleek website where I can send potential clients to hear my demo music.
Well, thanks for that plug, Kagan, and for the constant support. Another $5 a month donor, Sean Leisher from Allentown, where they're closing all the factories down. It's also hard to keep a good man down in Allentown, Pennsylvania.
I just became a $5 a month donor as a way to thank you guys for all you have given me these past couple of years. In just 2011 alone, without your show, I would have never discovered such amazing films like Certified Copy, Weekend, and a film that I finally got to watch on DVD, and if I would have seen it earlier, it would probably have tied with Drive for my favorite film of the year, A Separation.
Yeah, Sean sent us a great email. Thank you for all your kind words, and I'm glad that we are helping to turn you on to some of those great movies. A few other listeners that I want to mention here this week, Josh, because we overlooked them the past couple weeks, or I should say I overlooked them. We did make mention of their contributions, but didn't really get into their notes, and this comes from Ben Bronsink in Chattanooga, Tennessee. A while back, I found out that every single episode of Film Spotting is available on your archive page. I started listening from episode 1 through episode 220. I don't recommend anybody do this, by the way. It must be by chance that episode 220 is a review of The Dark Knight, and the episode I'm about to hear is on The Dark Knight Rises. In the old days, you called that a Cinecast coincidence, if I remember correctly. Thanks for all the work. I love Josh as a new co-host, which is why I'm now a monthly giver. Actually, Ben, thank you for the kind words about my new co-host, who's doing a wonderful job. We actually called it coincidence spotting.
That's not awkward at all.
That's even better. It's so much catchier.
Yeah,
coincidence spotting.
So.
But I was going to mention this actually too, that all three Film Spotting co-hosts have had a Christopher Nolan Batman movie to review in the first 6 months of their tenure.
Really?
Yeah, it's worked out perfectly that way, that Sam and I talked about Batman Begins, I think on episode number 18.
Okay.
The Dark Knight came out for episode 220 that first summer after Maddie joined the show, and you got The Dark Knight Rises. So
there you go.
Every Christopher Nolan film that comes out will have a new host.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I wouldn't be so fast, because you know what happens every time someone mentions that they're donating because of me? An angel gets its wings.
An angel gets its wings, and you get a cut, a bigger cut.
Nice.
Let's get to this one from Chris Massa in Pittsburgh.
I think it was when I was listening to the Dark Knight Rises spoiler podcast that it struck me. More than any other podcast, Film Spotting is the one I look forward to listening to most of all. That's when I came to terms with the fact that my year of freeloading had come to an end, and I had to donate something. I'm not able to make a large donation, and I fully intend to make larger ones in the future, but I hope it is at least a small indication of how much I appreciate what you do.
Absolutely, Chris. We appreciate every cent we get. And we close with this one from Jeremy Berg, who says, as a film school grad and struggling filmmaker, I can't tell you what your show has meant to me over the years. It's helped with my film education as well as inspiration for my own endeavors. For my part, I've recently completed directing my first feature-length film, Cedar Ridge. It's a psychological horror film that's already been filmed but needs a little push on Kickstarter to get our film up on the big screen. You can go there or to our website to check out our short teaser trailer. Huzzah, Jeremy. Congratulations on getting that in the can. We hope you have a lot of success with it, and we say thanks again to all of our generous donors this week.
This is Craig Brewer, the director of Black Snake Moan, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
This is Officer Daniels with the police department. I have a woman here saying one of your employees took money out of her purse.
You have a young lady who works at the register, about 19 years old, blonde.
Becky, come with me.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. Before we get to our fall movie preview, we wanted to share a few minutes of an interview with Craig Zobel, the writer-director of the new movie Compliance. That's the trailer you just heard a little bit from. The film is based on true, disturbing events involving a prank caller who convinces the manager of a fast food restaurant that one of her employees stole from a customer and must be detained and searched.
I really wish I could say the degradation ended there, but then Zobel wouldn't have much material to mine for this claustrophobic psychological horror movie that explores just how easy it is to obey authority and absolve yourself of responsibility regardless of whatever depraved acts you yourself commit. All the psych majors out there, Josh, right now are listening and nodding their heads and mumbling about the Milgram experiment that took place back at Yale in the early 60s. You actually haven't seen Compliance yet, unfortunately. It opens this weekend, and I do recommend it. Even if it qualifies for me as a one-timer, it's one of those films that is just disturbing enough I'll probably never jump at the chance to watch again. And I want to start at the end of my conversation with Craig Zobel because I buried the lead, I think. I saved the most provocative, interesting question for the end of the interview, and it concerns something that came up, Josh, when we reviewed Killer Joe recently on the show, which is how do you distinguish between exploitation and art when putting young, attractive naked women on display. I referenced with Zobel a recent article in The Atlantic that compares the two films and wrestles with that issue. Why don't you go ahead and read this paragraph from the article, which we'll link to in our show notes.
Are these filmmakers, one a distinguished master, that'd be William Friedkin, and one an up-and-comer, exposing the actors as a way of exposing the characters, using their humiliation to make their ordeals all the more visceral and affecting? Or are they having their cheesecake and eating it too, making their points about the degradation of these young women while simultaneously exploiting their sexiness to sell tickets? The question becomes particularly pointed in the case of Compliance, which concerns, again, minor spoiler, a character engaging in a kind of virtual voyeurism. If we allow ourselves to watch the paces that he and his surrogates on screen put this young woman through, are we any better than he is? Or is this the exact implication that the savvy filmmaker is intending?
Why don't we go ahead and hear from that savvy young filmmaker himself, Craig Zobel.
Here's the thing. I think that this stuff is really fascinating to talk about too. And I think that it actually brings up bigger questions about like nudity in film. And like, I think all of this is like really useful, good conversations to be having too. And it's like, I made decisions that I attempted to make. I mean, you said restrained. I attempted to make decisions that would like be on the right side of something. And I would love to know if eventually that I wasn't on the right side of those things. I reject the idea that I like wasn't thinking about it because I was. Do you know what I mean?
So no. It's like, and I don't think they're accusing you of that. The article itself seems very kind of mixed on it. But I think the fact that when you could have clearly made choices to obscure some of the nudity, the camera, the viewer didn't necessarily need to see your lead actress the way that we do. And was something gained from that, or was actually something lost from that, is what the article is ultimately posing. My concern primarily actually is what you said about how much you thought about it. I'm sure you did a lot. I want to know
the only thing you see in the film is her topless.
True.
Very specific to be, you know, now right. We have to talk about like how much nudity do you see? And it's like, it's so not even bare buttocks or anything like that. It's just toplessness, which is, you know, which I feel funny that we have to have this conversation in some ways, but I also think that it's important to kind of go down the road and say like, all right, it begs a bigger question about nudity in film and all this
exactly.
stuff. It's like, I did think it was important to see some, in the sense that I do think that there is some gravity to it that you could even distance yourself further from the story and put yourself in a place where you're not in that room with them. And your horse is comfortably a little bit higher the more distance you have.
Yeah.
And I think that it does something to stop that. We tried to be as tasteful as we could about a story about
very unsavory subject matter. Right.
And a story about, you know, gender and power dynamics and how people manipulate authority in gender relationships. And so it's about that stuff. I mean, it's
exactly.
about all of this stuff. And so it's like, yeah, I guess it's funny. Like, I'm happy to talk about that all day, honestly, because I ultimately, if the decision is that I kind of made the bad decisions there, that's fine. But it's funny, a lot of people see this film and who have seen it more than one time or saw it maybe at Sundance or when it first came out and then are revisiting it and discussing it with me, say like, but you re-edited it, you cut stuff out. And I'm like, no, I didn't.
The recollection of it
out.
Is that it's more graphic than it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can
Which
see
is
that
fascinating.
Because of our imaginations and because I think the room is so charged and we do feel like we're there in the room that we remember it in a
the
more horrifying way.
The words that everybody is saying, the words that the actors are saying to each other are very like charged and,
absolutely.
And stressful. And I think that is weirdly adding to the feeling of exploitation
sure.
in a visual way, which is just interesting. I don't know.
I did a bad thing.
That man's asked me to do things that ain't right.
Help me. Please stop talking.
You're almost like a real cop.
Huh. Again, that's just a piece of my conversation with Craig Zobel. The full interview, along with the full Mike Birbiglia chat, are available separately at filmspotting.net and in iTunes. In my conversation with Zobel, we also talked about what attracts him to stories about elaborate cons, which is on display both in Compliance and his debut film, Great World of Sound, and the criticism many have lobbed at Compliance that these people are just idiots. I've seen the comment in various places online that I'd never do something like this, which I find pretty hilarious, frankly, Josh. As for the question of nudity and exploitation, it obviously requires a lot more time than we have to give it here. It would also help, obviously, if you had seen Compliance, so maybe this is something that we can dive into at a later date. I guess I want to note that I find Zobel's take on it satisfying. And I also think that when you're dealing with movies like this, where maybe it's not as direct as, say, a scene like the one I'm thinking of from Funny Games US, where Michael Haneke shows us Naomi Watts on screen as the mother and really degrades her by making her strip for the camera. That's a case where he's openly challenging you as an audience member. It's meta from the very first frame. There's a sort of explicit dialogue going on with filmmaker and the audience. It's not as explicit in Compliance or Killer Joe, and yet it's very much there. I think even going back to Killer Joe, there's a scene where the actress Juno Temple has to take her clothes off by framing it in a way where Matthew McConaughey is in the foreground and not looking at her, but the camera sees her in the background and we have to look at her. That dialogue is happening with the audience. These directors know what they're doing, and I find it hard to have my buttons pushed by filmmakers who are very clearly pushing my buttons. When a movie works, when the filmmaker is clearly trying to produce a certain reaction and it does provoke that reaction, I can't get too outraged by that. I think these are just very skilled filmmakers. I think, of course, then you can go from there and say that another question would be, well, does that actually make it better or worse that they're saying, yes, I know I'm doing something wrong, but at least I know it, so you should let me off the hook? That's a fair question.
Well, let me ask you this quickly about Compliance. Were you bothered by how it's handled there more before you got a chance to talk to him about it? I mean, was it something that you kind of came around on, or you were okay with
it? I wasn't bothered by it.
Okay.
I wasn't really bothered by it.
Because we both had problems with Killer Joe's handling of it. So
yeah, I think, though, I noted with Killer Joe a couple other scenarios where I think in that scene, it almost has to be shot the way it's shot. I think it fits in with some of the larger themes of the film and the way he is challenging us as an audience member. There are some scenes where that dialogue with the audience isn't happening as much, and yet I still felt like the camera was leering. That troubled me more, but some of those scenes that I think people really respond to in Killer Joe and what they'll see in Compliance if they haven't already, those don't bother me because, like I said, I think I know what they're up to, or I feel like I know what questions they're trying to provoke in the audience, so I don't get too bothered by it. But it's a fascinating conversation to have. I appreciate Craig Zobel having that discussion with me.
Good cold evening, gentlemen. Amongst your inventory, I've been led to believe is a specimen I'm keen to acquire.
When I hear that trumpet sound...
What's your name?
I'm on a rise right out of the ground.
Django. Then you're exactly the one I'm looking for.
Hey, stop talking to him.
Calm down. I'm simply a customer trying to conduct a transaction.
Last chance, fancy pants.
Oh, very well.
Well, how's that for a segue? We go from a discussion of nudity and violence and exploitation to a Quentin Tarantino film. That's the trailer for his upcoming Django Unchained, though by upcoming, I believe it's actually Christmas when it's going to be released. So we're still a few months off from that film. However, it is one of those highly anticipated fall releases that we're both very excited about, and we know many listeners are as well. But there are a lot of intriguing films slated for this fall, and maybe the best way to kick off our fall movie preview is to start with our poll question this week, which you can vote in at filmspotting.net. This came from a listener, Lance St. Laurent, who wrote, "Gun to your head, which would you rather see, Django Unchained or The Master?" We took that a step further, rephrased it a little bit, and put it this way. You've got one ticket and can only pick one of these highly anticipated fall movies. You will never get to see the other. That's the catch. You'll never see the other film. Which one of them do you choose? Josh, the two films are?
Django, of course, but also The Master, Paul Thomas Anderson's
new film. Comes out in September. Those are your two choices. We want to know which film you pick. Vote now at filmspotting.net. And that helps us with our list a little bit because we actually set aside five movies. I like how you phrased it, Josh. They're the usual suspects. I call it the duh list. This is kind of the list that I feel like it's obvious that our listeners could probably pick these five films for us and say, yep, these are the ones Adam and Josh would be most curious about. But also, I'm guessing many of our listeners would have these films in their lists as well in some order or another. So, Josh, what are the usual suspects top five here?
We've got Lincoln, then The Hobbit, then Looper, and rounded out by the two we've discussed, Django Unchained and The Master.
Lincoln is the Steven Spielberg film with Daniel Day-Lewis starring as the title character. That comes out November 9th. The Hobbit, Peter Jackson's film, is December 14th. And Rian Johnson's Looper opens September 28th. As you know, we close with Django Unchained and The Master. And for me, those top three are my top three. If I wasn't excluding them for the purposes of this list, it would be The Master, Django Unchained, and Looper. So in answer to the poll question, I'd go with The Master. As much as I love Tarantino, that's the film I'm more dying to see than any film I can think of in recent memory. What about you?
I think I'd agree, because I think Anderson right now is the more vital filmmaker, just the stage of his career. That's what it feels like to me, at least.
Hmm. For me, The Hobbit is one I'm not as excited about as you, and that's not me trying to be provocative and make people angry. I just have to admit,
you don't care about Hobbits.
I don't care about Hobbits. It's not really in my top 15 or 20 most anticipated fall movies. And Lincoln, I'm not dying to see it, but I am dying to see Daniel Day-Lewis in that title role.
That's probably the most interesting aspect of it. The historical biography does not get me very excited, even when it's Spielberg. But it'll be interesting to see those two together.
Okay, so those are the obvious top five most anticipated fall movies. Let's get into our personal list here after we've set those aside. I do want to mention that the movie Mud, directed by and written by our guy, Jeff Nichols, who was so gracious to come on our Sight and Sound show last week and talk about his official ballot. That movie right now doesn't have a 2012 release. It's looking like a 2013 release, so it's not eligible.
You didn't ask him that. That wasn't one of your questions,
I know. I didn't want to give him anything hard-hitting. I was just so happy to have him on the show, Josh. But Mud otherwise would certainly be in that top five.
Definitely.
Obvious list, but it's not eligible. So what's your number five?
Well, my list will get a little more personal after this, because I think this is commonly seen on a lot of fall previews, but Anna Karenina is number five.
Really? Joe Wright?
Yep. Now, attempting this is pure folly, to adapt this Tolstoy novel. I'm about halfway through it. I know you don't want to hear this. You don't want me reading anything at all.
No.
But reading it now and just being halfway through, this thing is so massive. It's so expansive. So many perspectives going on. Yet it's astonishingly intimate. So that's going to be the real challenge here. But the fact that this is director Joe Wright gives me some hope, particularly because of the lively way he made what was a completely unnecessary stab at Pride and Prejudice feel so vital. I didn't really need that movie either, but it turned out to be really quite good. He's also reteaming with Keira Knightley after Pride and Prejudice and Your Precious Atonement.
I can't say it. I actually get a little electroshock every time I mention it now.
Good,
so.
Good. Now, while I'm having a hard time here seeing Knightley as Anna Karenina, I'm going to put that aside. I know that's one of your concerns about reading books ahead of time. I will be willing to set that aside and see how they've envisioned the character. So
it's
I'm
not
eager
just
to
that.
See this.
It's not just that, though. It also is that Keira Knightley has kind of proven to be a little bit of a lightweight, hasn't she, throughout her career?
I don't know if I would say lightweight. I mean, I think she makes Pride and Prejudice, which is another heavy literary, not as heavy as this piece of work. I think she pulls that off. So I think she's capable. It's something more about where the character is in my head now as I read. So I will be careful to set that aside, though. Once I'm done with the book, I'll move on to the movie.
Well, a little disclaimer before I get any hate mail. There are Keira Knightley performances I enjoy, and she is very good, I think, in that film that shall not be mentioned. Joe writes, Anna Karenina is an honorable mention for me on this list. It comes out November 16th, so right around Thanksgiving is when that is slated for release.
Actions of Iran shocked the civilized world.
Go, go, go! Shred everything!
Our embassy has been seized and more than 60 American citizens continue to be held as hostages.
If we're going to go, then we need to go now.
My number five is the new Ben Affleck drama, in which he also stars, Argo, which is scheduled to open October 12th. It's a drama about an insane CIA mission where, under the guise of the making of a film, they tried to get six Americans from Iran out during the hostage crisis. And Lord knows I found ways to tear down both of Affleck's previous directing efforts, Gone Baby Gone and The Town, even as I respected much of both of them. And I'm a sucker for espionage movies. I'm an even bigger sucker, as you know, Josh, for movies about making movies. So merging those two genres together is something I'm really curious about. And I want to see Ben Affleck work outside of his comfort zone a little bit and work on a project of this scale. The Town and Gone Baby Gone both were kind of neighborhood films. So I think this will be an interesting challenge for him. I think he's up to it as a director based on what I've seen in those two films, even if I nitpicked a lot of things here and there. He also stars in the film. And check out this cast. I'm going to just read you some names that are in this ensemble. Bryan Cranston, Alan Arkin, John Goodman, everyone's favorite football coach, Kyle Chandler, Michael Parks, Chris Messina, Richard Kind, Carrie Bechet, one of my top upcoming actresses, and Philip Baker Hall are all in this movie. So what more do you need?
Yeah, that's good stuff. This is going to be a big step in terms of his directorial career. That's the interesting thing about it. A lot of juggling of different types of films, too. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, I mean, there's the political stuff, but it seems like this is going to have some comedy or at least satire in it, too.
Really?
Of course, a period piece. Well, at least with the filmmaking aspect of it, I think there's going to be a little bit of that. So it'll be interesting to see. It seems like this has the elements, too, for a real Oscar magnet. So,
agreed.
And I kind of feel like Affleck's career is being managed toward that eventuality.
Maybe.
So we'll see if it happens here. My number four is a little bit of a smaller film called The Man with the Iron Fist. Although I'm partial to martial arts movies, it's not The Promise of Kung Fu that has me putting this on my list. It's the bizarre concoction of elements. Let's start with the director.
I didn't know you were a Wu-Tang fan.
Well, yes, RZA is directing. And if my contacts in the hip-hop industry are correct, that's how you pronounce it. I believe it is RZA.
Correct.
He's one of the founders of the Wu-Tang Clan, of course, and he's been acting in films since 1999's Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai. That's the Jim Jarmusch film with martial arts undercurrents. Here, RZA dives all the way in, though. He's writing and he's directing a film. It's about a blacksmith in feudal China whose village is attacked. Alongside him in this cast is almost as interesting as the one in Argo. He's got Lucy Liu, Pam Grier, and Russell Crowe. How does that sound?
Love it.
So something's going to happen here. It could be disastrous. It could be awesome, but I'm eagerly anticipating it.
Well, my number four film that I'm eagerly anticipating comes out December 21st. And I have to say, Josh, I didn't realize I was yearning for a movie about Pete and Debbie. The characters played by Leslie Mann and Paul Rudd in Judd Apatow's Knocked Up. But that's what we're going to get this Christmas, and I can't wait to see This Is 40, which picks up with this couple. I like them as characters, and I like those performers, especially Paul Rudd from Knocked Up, but they were kind of stereotypes. They were supporting players who embodied a certain notion of marriage for people in their mid-30s. But if you watch the trailer and you trust it, Leslie Mann seems to be the one who is taking on a larger role here and really driving the story forward, whereas she's always been in smaller roles in these Judd Apatow films, even as she's married to him.
Yeah, she really deserves that chance, too.
Why does it say 38 and not 40?
Because your mom wants to be 38. Let's not mention it again.
On your form, you said you were born in 1974, but your paper, it said 72.
It's 1974.
Oh, wait. On your last form, you said that you were born in 1975.
I've been working on my rewrite.
I lie about my age, okay?
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
Okay.
I know how old you are by counting the rings.
I've made a list. It's the do better list. We're 40 years old. If we don't do it now, when are we going to do it? Your eyes are kind of glazing over.
No, I'm processing it all.
I really wish, Josh, I could tell you I was making up the fact that just this week I sat down and made a list of all the things I want to change or start in my life in order to be the man I really want to be. But I'd be lying.
You did make
that
list.
I have a birthday coming up, and it's not 40, thank goodness, but it's close enough. And it did make me take stock, and I think this movie is going to hit way too close to home.
The problem is you make that list quarterly, though. So
I know, that's true. I am an avid list maker, as everyone knows who's listening to this show.
I've got a counter, though. Actually, I think this movie is being made because the Pete and Debbie characters were fully developed, even though they were supporting in Knocked Up. I mean, I think people wanted to learn more about them, and that's part of the reason this is made. Now,
There was just something about the kind of bickering of marriage that seemed like it was
fertile
comedic ground.
They gave them like an extra
ground,
plot thread that they followed along. I mean,
I agree.
This makes sense to me. It's not like,
I'm
why
not
in
it
the world
make
are
sense.
They doing that?
I just never considered I'd want to see an entire movie about them.
Okay.
But I'm glad.
I'm resisting. It's an honorable mention, and the part of me is resisting it is because I am so much in the target demo that I kind of just have that, like, you know, there's something in me that I don't want to see that movie that was me made.
See, you won't embrace
just
it. And you won't admit how close to home it's going to hit.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
The fact, too, is that Judd Apatow made Knocked Up and the 40-year-old version, which I love. And I also really enjoyed Funny People. So he makes movies I like. And I think this one, based on the trailer, is going to be another one that I like.
Yeah, I really have loved all the stuff, too, so I'll be there. All right, my number three is Frankenweenie. Now, I know, Adam, I've lost any hope of turning you into a Tim Burton fan.
I can't believe you have any hope left.
Dragging you to Dark Shadows, and worse, convincing you to review it, that did not work out well for either of us. Still, I'm excited about this feature-length version of Burton's early short, which is about a boy who reanimates his dead dog. Just love that idea. I know this isn't an original piece of work, but at least it's coming this time, which hasn't happened in a while, from Burton's own id. And it's also going to be in the art form that I think he excels at, which is stop motion animation. I'd put Corpse Bride, his last work in stop motion, among his best films. So Frankenweenie still holds great promise.
He was a great dog, a great friend.
The best dog a kid could have.
When you lose someone you love, they never really leave you. They just move into a special place in your heart.
I don't want him in my heart. I want him here with me.
I know. If we could bring him back, we would.
Well, how's this for a transition here on Film Spotting? We're sharing our top five most anticipated fall movies. We go from Josh's pick, Frankenweenie, to my pick. It comes out December 19th, Amour. Which, of course,
yes. I knew you'd
French.
Try to show me up.
Michael Haneke. It's a French language film that won the Palme d'Or at the recent Cannes Film Festival. Stars Jean-Louis Trintignant, great, great actor, Emmanuel Riva and Isabelle Huppert. And it's a story about an elderly couple, and the wife suffers a stroke, which leaves her paralyzed on one side of her body. And it explores their new dynamic, their new relationship that forms between the couple after she suffers the stroke. It's hard to go wrong with Jean-Louis Trintignant, an actor I love from the great Bertolucci film The Conformist. Love Isabelle Huppert in many films, especially The Piano Teacher, which she made with Michael Haneke. And Emmanuel Riva is a French actress I didn't know by name, but she was in the Kieślowski film Three Colors Blue with Juliette Binoche. And she's also the lead character, the female character, in the great Alain René film from 1959, Hiroshima, Mon Amour. So an illustrious cast here. And it makes me think a little bit, just based on the description, of Away From Her, mm-hmm. the film starring Julie Christie and Gordon Pinsent. The debut from Sarah Pauley. I hope it's as good, if not better, than that film, because I did really like that film. It also makes me think a little bit of The Straight Story. You talk about David Lynch making a movie that seems out of his comfort zone by being so straightforward and having a real logical narrative like that movie was in comparison to his other movies. When I think of Michael Haneke, I think of Funny Games, and I think of Cachet and The Piano Teacher, these really dark psychological movies, oftentimes very violent. The White Ribbon is another one that comes to mind. He loves to really challenge his audiences. I'm sure this one will be a challenge too, but for him, it seems a little bit like his Straight Story, perhaps. So I really want to see what he's going to do with the material.
With that pick, balance has been restored in the film spotting
nice.
World. No, I had Amour as an honorable mention, so good pick. I'm going to go for my number two with the work of a director who I realized recently has become the most mentioned director in my top five list so far this year. That's Robert Zemeckis and his film Flight. Now, because of Roger Rabbit, Back to the Future, What Lies Beneath even, I've mentioned him quite a bit. But this time he's doing something that looks interesting because it's getting away from the motion capture stuff that I feel he's kind of gotten bogged down in, although I've appreciated some things about those films. It's certainly not as good as some of the earlier things he's done. Denzel Washington plays an airline pilot here who prevents a jet from crashing, and he's lauded as a hero until other factors are revealed in the ensuing investigation. I think even, what was the other Zemeckis film that I mentioned? Romancing the Stone.
Mm-hmm.
He's just a director that is so commercial. Obviously, he's so commercial, yet is able to work within those confines and still do really impressive things and come up with really interesting stories. Flight seems to have the potential to be another one of those.
We're spending billions of dollars. We are still no closer to defeating our enemy.
20 detainees recognize that photo.
No birth certificate, no cell phone. You guys are ghosts.
He's right in the inner circle.
The whole world's gonna want in on this.
I want targets.
Where was the last time you saw Bin Laden?
Oh my God, is that what I think it is?
Where was the last time you saw Bin Laden?
That's the teaser trailer for my number two most anticipated fall movie scheduled to come out December 19th, Zero Dark Thirty, the film about the special ops mission to capture or kill Osama bin Laden. It reteams a pair that worked very well together on a great movie from a few years ago, The Hurt Locker. That's Mark Boal, the screenwriter, and Catherine Bigelow, the director. great cast in this movie. Jessica Chastain, who, of course, had one of the best years ever last year for an actress in Take Shelter, among many other movies. Joel Edgerton's another younger actor that I'm really looking forward to seeing. And Edgar Ramirez, who's the star of Carlos. And I believe of that year, that was my number one male lead performance. Really talented actor. Edgar Ramirez also in Zero Dark Thirty. This was a movie that was going to be about the unsuccessful mission to try to capture Osama bin Laden. Obviously would have been a completely different movie, but when real life intervene, that changed their story completely. Who knows? Maybe that would have been a more interesting film than the one we're ultimately going to get. But I am really excited to see what they do with this new story. From what I understand, it's about the people who are kind of behind the scenes, not the military people or the big political figures pulling some of the strings. It's really about the people doing the grunt work in the field to accomplish a mission like that. I think that's an interesting angle to take. And as I said, reteaming that pairing from The Hurt Locker definitely gives this film a pedigree that makes me want to see it.
Zero Dark Thirty, honorable mention for me. So yeah, I'm glad it's on your list. My number one, though, is a film I've been looking forward to all year. It's Killing Them Softly. I do wish this had come out of Cannes with a little bit more fanfare, so I've kind of tempered my expectations a bit. But still, this is the new film from writer-director Andrew Dominik, whose The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford still lingers for me in mesmerizing ways, especially as this somber meditation on the dark side of celebrity status. He's reteaming with Brad Pitt, who was his Jesse James. This time, Pitt plays a mob enforcer. And he's surrounded. We've been talking a lot about good casts in the films coming up. Listen to who Pitt's surrounded by. All sorts of movie tough guys. Ray Liotta, James Gandolfini, Sam Shepard, and Ben Mendelsohn, who you remember from Animal Kingdom.
Joel Edgerton.
Yeah, that's what I think of as Animal Kingdom when I hear his name.
Yep.
I get this vibe that Killing Them Softly could be my drive for 2012, if that makes any sense. Sort of this art house reverie on violence and masculinity. So we'll see what it really holds.
Yeah, it's a movie that's an honorable mention for me. I just saw the trailer playing before Cosmopolis.
Oh, okay.
And I am even more intrigued by it now. And I know it's just a trailer, and they're often misleading.
You've been watching a lot of trailers lately for someone who hates trailers.
Well, I do hate trailers, but if I get stuck in a movie, I'm not going to avert my eyes, Josh, okay? And I saw this one trailer. I don't know what it is about Brad Pitt, but something happened when that guy turned 40 and he became a great actor.
Oh,
I can tell from the trailer alone.
You're coming around.
From the trailer alone, Brad Pitt looks mesmerizing in Killing Them Softly. Just really great. I can't wait to see what he does with it. And I'm vowing to find the time to rewatch The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, because it's a film that I've mentioned multiple times, a little bit underwhelmed by, respected it, didn't love it, but I only saw it once, and I saw it in that terrible, oftentimes, movie environment of a film festival, where I think it was my fourth or fifth film of the day, and it started at 9:30.
Oh, that would be a rough one to do,
and
fourth or fifth, yeah.
It really isn't the ideal situation to see a movie, especially such a lyrical one as The Assassination of Jesse James. So it's one I'm definitely going to make the time to see again. My number one most anticipated fall movie is also the top pick for friend of the show, Chris Klemek.
Hey guys, it's Chris Klemek calling in from Washington, D.C. If we take Django Unchained and The Master out of the running, the fall film I'm most looking forward to is Martin McDonagh's Seventh Psychopath. It's only his second feature. His debut in Bruges was one of my favorite movies of 2008, but I'm a huge fan of McDonagh's plays as well. In 2010, I went up to New York to see his play I'd Be Handing in Spokane, which starred Christopher Walken, Anthony Mackie, and Sam Rockwell. Seventh Psychopaths reunites him with Walken and Rockwell from that play, as well as with Colin Farrell from In Bruges, and throws Abbie Cornish and Tom Waits in the mix as well. The combination of McDonagh's script and direction with that cast, you know, there are no sure things, but I have a very good feeling about this one. Take care, guys. Thanks.
Chris, in being very excited for Martin McDonagh's Seven Psychopaths, he's got a release date of October 12th. This is his follow-up as a writer and director to In Bruges, a film that was highly praised here on Film Spotting. It's about a struggling screenwriter who becomes caught up in the L.A. crime scene after he and his friends somehow kidnapped a gangster's shih tzu. That's the basic plot here. But if anyone could make that riveting, I think it's Martin McDonagh. He got the best performance of his career out of Colin Farrell in In Bruges, and he stars in this movie with this troika, Josh, of comedic character actors: Woody Harrelson, Sam Rockwell, Christopher Walken.
That's good stuff.
That's who Colin Farrell stars with in this movie. I really want to see what Martin McDonagh is going to do with that material and with those actors in Seven Psychopaths. Josh, what about honorable mentions for you? What were the tough ones to overlook?
Well, I did have three that were on your list. Amour, This Is 40, and Zero Dark 30. And then a couple we haven't mentioned yet, Like Someone in Love is the latest from Abbas Kiarostami, set in Japan, so that should be pretty intriguing. And then Alps, which we're hoping to review soon on the
possibly
show.
Possibly next
we'll
week or the week after.
Yeah, this is the follow-up from Yorgos Lanthimos, the director of Dogtooth.
Yeah. And that's all you need to say for me to be really excited about that film. I also had in my honorable mentions two movies from your list, Killing Him Softly and Anna Karenina. Also, The Impossible. This is starring, I think, Ewan McGregor, definitely Naomi Watts, directed by Juan Antonio Bayona, who did The Orphanage. And that's all I really needed was Naomi Watts and that director from El Orfanato, a movie I really love from 3 or 4 years ago. I don't even care what it's about. I want to see it if they're involved. Silver Linings Playbook comes out November 21st. That's the new film with Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence, an actor we both really like.
It seems like an odd pairing.
That's the new David O. Russell film, though, which is the key to that one. And I like that you mentioned Like Someone in Love, the Abbas Kiarostami film. That one and Holy Motors, another big breakout hit from the recent Cannes Film Festival, directed by Leo Carrad. Those are films that may not come out until 2013.
Might not get here until next year.
Otherwise,
yeah.
I really would have strongly considered putting Kiarostami in my top five, but I know they're playing at the New York Film Festival in October, but otherwise there isn't a release date set, so we had to exclude them. Those are our top five most anticipated fall movies. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and at Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Out wide this weekend, Lawless, the new film starring Shia LaBeouf, directed by John Hillcoat. The Possession, and Josh, what is Oogie Loves in the Big Balloon Adventure?
I don't know, but my gut tells me this is one, if you're going to see it, you've got to see it on the big screen. Don't put it off for DVD. Don't miss your chance.
I can't wait for the emails to come in telling us what we're missing with Oogie Loves. Out in limited release opening here in Chicago and select cities, Mike Birbiglia's Sleepwalk With Me and Craig Zobel's Compliance, both films I recommend. And also Oslo, August 31st. This is the new film from the Norwegian, don't call him Danish, Joachim Trier.
No.
That one is another film I'm looking forward to, and we may just review it next week on the show, or it might be Alps, which is the Greek film that opens next weekend at the Gene Siskel Film Center. We'll also get to the final film in our contemporary Iranian cinema marathon, Offside, and the top five list, it's up in the air. If you got any great ideas, you know where to find us. Yeah, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ. Our featured artist was Rubens Accomplice. You can learn more at rubensaccomplice.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.